This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are some of the stories for the week of February 16th, 2026. The Maricopa County Board of Supervisors agreed to give key election duties back to recorder Justin Heap, who sued the board over the issue. Wayne Shutsky reports.
The board approved a resolution agreeing to give Heap control of early voting and his own IT staff, key points of contention that led to the recorder's lawsuit last year. The supervisors say they approved the resolution on their own because Heap's attorney won't respond to an offer to settle the case that included many of the same concessions. Corey Langhofer, the board's attorney, says he sent the most recent offer to Heap's lawyer earlier this month, but he says Heap's team has refused to respond with a counteroffer in writing.
His request to me was that I should put in writing his deal points and send it back to Heap as though it were your offer. And I said, it's not their offer. You've got their offer. It's in writing.
Supervisor Debbie Lesko says the board and Heap had actually reached an agreement on 95% of the issues last April, before Heap even filed the lawsuit. And she accused the recorder of failing to negotiate in good faith.
We have given him what he wants, but yet he has not responded, which is very frustrating to me. I don't understand it.
The judge overseeing the case has repeatedly called on the board and recorder to resolve their issues outside of the courtroom. The supervisors argue the new resolution shows their commitment to do just that. Wayne Shutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In culture news. This year, as America celebrates its 250th anniversary, Arizona is highlighting community-led events, many showcasing state history. As Jill Ryan reports in the first of a two-part series, war reenactors recently descended on an abandoned mining town to relive the days of the Civil War and the lesser-known Indian Wars.
While the westernmost Civil War battle took place at Picacho Pass, 50 miles northwest of Tucson, these few dozen reenactors brought their tents and muskets to Vulture City, a preserved ghost town abandoned decades ago after its gold mine closed. Their goal was not to relive the actual battle per se, but instead to transcend their knowledge to show an audience what a historically accurate battle would have looked like if it had taken place on the outskirts of Wickenburg.
There's a cannon over there.
Double ray.
They must have rolled it in.
That's Dave Williamson, president of the nonprofit Arizona Civil War Council. Here, he's captain of the 1st U.S. Infantry Regiment, Company D, or the Union side.
So it's not necessarily, ooh, bangy, bangy, look, they're bangy, banging at each other. It's the maneuvers that they do, the uniforms that they wear, and sometimes kind of the tactics.
Reload, boys, quickly. Shot for that guy right there.
29-year-old Devin Ross is the captain of the Helms Arizona Guard, or the Confederate side. Reenacting since childhood, Ross says this battle is more of a skirmish.
Tactically, it's a little different. There's not a lot of commands. When it comes down to skirmishing, it's more of just fire and forget. And then the Yankees were more of in a file line, which is where you'll get a lot more commands for, like, your ready, aim, fire.
Though replicas, these are real guns firing blanks. The reenacting soldiers and allies range from teens to seniors. Some are women, some are natives, some are related to each other, and some are actual war vets. Leadership picks the battle's winner beforehand, kind of like a WWE wrestling match.
And how do they go back and forth? How are we going to go around the buildings? How do we do things safely?
Gilbert Alonzo from Phoenix portrays a Union soldier. His two sons and daughter-in-law are in the Union Army, too. His eldest son got him into reenacting 20 years ago, and he's since discovered a familial connection to the Civil War.
Yeah, my ancestor, his name was Sonovio Cordova, Hispanic man in New Mexico, and he was in a spy unit. And they would spy on the Confederates, infiltrate their camps. If they had been caught, they'd have been hanged as a spy.
Front! Forward! Forward!
Their uniforms, garb, weaponry, and gear range in authenticity, but still it could run the bill up into the thousands. The reenactors wear modern-day earplugs for protection, some wear modern footwear or glasses. Under the Arizona sun, these Union soldiers are in wool uniforms. The Confederates are not, And that was enough for at least one club member, Andrew Cool, to switch sides.
There's a lot more individuality on the rebel side.
In Confederate garb, Cool wears prescription glasses customized to look historically accurate. He also has two lip piercings.
We got more colors to choose from, different clothing options, you know, all that great stuff. Probably use different more guns. It's just a lot more fun. If you like playing a Civil War Barbie, then be a rebel.
In the club, politics are left at the door. Why a person joins the Union or the Confederacy doesn't just rest on personal preference. It's also about having even teams. Indian scouts portrayed by actual Apaches join the Confederate side. In character, Masai Leon justified to an audience why.
So, usually we fight for the Americans, bluecoats in this case, but the Confederates gave us this Confederate $5 bill. Oh. So my uncle and I here have no concept of money, but our interpreter here was like, sure, we'll go fight for you guys for five Confederate dollars.
As for the rebel Confederate flag, the one often associated with white supremacy movements, it's actually nowhere on the battlefield. Here's Williamson.
I was never flown in Arizona, so historically wise, we run what's called the First National Confederate Flag, which is basically a bars and a couple of stars in a circle.
Fire! Okay. Charge bayonets! Charge! Yeah! Take your guns!
As the skirmish ends, the reenactors who lay dead moments before help each other up to a trumpet cue, ready for the next war. Jill Ryan, KJZZ News, reporting from Vulture City.
You can find both stories from the series, Two Wars, One Ghost Town, at wars.kjzz.org. And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening.
Rio Salado College is hosting the Dash with Rio 5K and 10K Run Walk in Tempe on Saturday, April 18th. This community event welcomes runners and walkers of all levels with early bird registration for a limited time. Details at dashwithrio.com.
In business news, spring training is back. If you haven't noticed already, you will soon, as the Valley fills with baseball fans from around the country to soak up some sun while getting an up-close view of their favorite teams and players. The Phoenix area is now the spring home to half of all major league teams, while generating hundreds of millions of dollars in annual revenue for the region. Phil Latzman looks back at the evolution of the Cactus League in Arizona with some baseball lifers.
Moving out Arizona way, it's the San Francisco Giants, who are off and running, hopeful they'll connect for a pennant in their fifth season on the West Coast.
That's an old newsreel clip from 1962. The Giants have actually been coming to Arizona since 1947, when they were still in New York, and segregation played a big role in teams heading west. That same year, the Cleveland Indians, now known as the Guardians, relocated to Tucson to avoid Florida's severe Jim Crow laws in order to integrate the American League's first black player, Larry Doby. In 1952, the Chicago Cubs made their first appearance in Mesa, and by the 60s, Arizona's Cactus League had a half dozen teams. As late as 1989, the state had just eight teams, but in the years since, seven more would leave Florida's Grapefruit League for better accommodations in the desert. And nowadays, exactly half of Major League Baseball is here each spring, with 15 teams and 10 stadiums dotting the valley. D-backs manager Torrey Lovello remembers when Arizona wasn't the main attraction.
I know when I was a player, this was the other state. Every team seemed to be in Florida.
But now he says the area is not only home to more spring games, but also more year-round residents.
The evolution of spring training has also changed from a player standpoint, because I think a lot of the players live here in Arizona in their offseason, so they get an extra month at home.
Craig Counsell won a World Series as a player here with the Diamondbacks in 2001. He's now the manager of the Chicago Cubs, longtime residents of Mesa.
It's the greatest place for baseball fans in the month of March. You know, you get an intimate ballpark, you can see multiple games a day, you get great weather, you can sit on a grass berm and watch Major League players. I mean, you can see, you can do it right, and you can see seven ballparks in 4 days probably if you want.
But that wouldn't be cheap, because tickets now can average more than $50 each, depending on location and opponent. But Council says the games haven't lost their intimacy.
For the most part, hasn't lost that feel of like it's spring training, and there's a casualness to it that I think makes the players happier a lot, you know what I mean, if that makes sense? Like, makes the players a little more friendly, because it's not the competition. It allows fans to get closer to players, and I think that's great. and that hasn't gone anywhere.
Few people have been to more spring training games than Reds manager Terry Francona, who began tagging along with his dad in the 1960s.
Yeah, I remember watching my dad like a week before camp. He'd be running out the back road with a big sweatsuit on, trying to sweat out 10 pounds or whatever. I don't remember ever seeing him swing a bat or take BP somewhere. You know, when they went to spring training, they played themselves into shape.
Francona's dad was longtime major leaguer Tito Francona. And Terry went on to star at the University of Arizona and played 10 seasons of his own in the bigs. He's now one of the most successful managers in baseball, having won over 2,000 games and a pair of World Series titles with the Red Sox. He says the game hasn't changed, but the player's approach to it has.
That is really different now. I mean, guys come in to camp in shape. They work. They're more athletic. They get after it pretty good.
Francona says it's easier for players to stay in shape since Cactus League travel is limited to the Valley after all remaining teams left Tucson in 2010. Stark contrast from the Grapefruit League, where the teams are spread out all over Florida.
The travel is so easy. Like, it's so much easier to get your work done because, you know, you take BP at your own place and get in the car, get on the bus and go 20 minutes and play a game. It's way easier.
It's also easy money and a big boost to the local economy. A study by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business showed the 2025 Cactus League season generated an estimated $764 million in economic impact for the state, with about half of that coming from outside visitors. It also generated more than $32 million in state taxes and is responsible for more than 6,000 annual jobs in Arizona. Play ball. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
In education news, members of the Scottsdale Unified School District Governing Board are at odds over how to make necessary budget cuts. From the Education Desk, Bridget Dowd has details.
The district is looking for cost-saving options as it faces a nearly $8 million budget shortfall. The board has already approved two school closures and was considering cutting the number of guidance counselors, but that raised concerns from students like Vivian Spire.
Part of the reason my brother was able to attend a top 10 university was because he and our counselor were able to have a relationship where she could write him a personalized recommendation letter. If we cut down on counselors, there is no way for the remaining counselors to have enough time to really get to know each student.
Board member Matthew Patinsky was also concerned about cutting vital staff members. He advocated for closing more underutilized schools to preserve the resources they offer.
The fastest way to continue to decline in enrollments is to do what seems fair and spread pain and spread costs and slowly dilute the quality of the experience.
Other board members suggested cutting marketing dollars, but some say that's important to attracting more students. They've chosen not to change the ratio of counselors to students for now, which leaves the district with a smaller cushion of savings. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In science news, the way you drive later in life could serve as an early warning sign of cognitive decline or dementia years before symptoms emerge. Kathy Ritchie has this story.
Before you start diagnosing every driver in the Phoenix area with dementia, keep in mind more research is still needed. Dr. Chia Long Pua is a physician scientist at Barrow Neurological Institute. She says they analyzed driving data, as well as MRI scans over several years of more than 200 participants who initially did not have memory problems.
And so what we saw was that people who had more of these white matter damage, they tended over time to drive less. They make fewer trips.
White matter damage is caused by reduced blood flow to tiny vessels in the brain.
Those who later on that did develop cognitive problems, they were more likely to have these sort of unsafe driving events and crashes.
And those changes in driving patterns showed up years before the individual was formally diagnosed. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays is asking a Maricopa County Superior Court judge to review a decision that greenlights a massive data center proposal near Tucson. From the Fronteras desk, Elisa Resnick has more.
The Arizona Corporation Commission approved a plan late last year put forth by developer Beale Infrastructure to build a data center on a 290-acre stretch of Pima County land that would be cooled using electricity from Tucson Electric Power. Where it'll get the water it needs for day-to-day operations is still unclear. In a court filing this week, May says the agreement has TEP and Beale setting electricity rates between themselves. She argues that violates the Arizona Constitution, which gives the ACC exclusive authority to set utility rates. She's asking the court to vacate the ACC's approval of the plan. Alisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And finally, from KJZZ's The Show, co-host Sam Dingman reveals details of the surprise ICE warehouse that could house up to 10,000 detainees for months at a time, according to new documents.
We have acquired a pair of documents that offer concrete details about the Department of Homeland Security's plans for the warehouse it recently purchased in Surprise. After weeks of speculation about what the 400,000-square-foot warehouse might be used for, the documents confirm it will be retrofitted as an ICE detention center, potentially housing 7 to 10,000 detainees for months at a time, numbers much higher than previously known. But Surprise Mayor Kevin Sarter says critical questions still have not been answered.
What they plan to do with it, and you know, some of the impacts it's going to have on our city with, you know, police, fire, traffic, those types of things.
After news of the warehouse purchase broke, some Surprise residents felt blindsided. At an emotional five-hour city council meeting in early February, over 80 citizens denounced the purchase. They demanded answers about what steps were being taken to keep potential detainees and Surprise residents safe, and what impact the project will have on the city's resources and economy. U.S. Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, U.S. Representative Paul Gosar, and Mayor Sarter sent letters to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem asking for transparency. While Congressman Gosar did not receive a specific reply to his letter, DHS did apparently send him a pair of documents last week containing specifics about possible uses for the warehouse, as well as an economic impact analysis. Gosar's office shared those documents with Mayor Sarter and the Surprise City Council, who shared them with us. The warehouse, according to one of the documents, is part of a broader DHS project called the ICE Detention Reengineering Initiative. Facilities acquired as part of the initiative fall into two categories: regional processing centers, housing an average daily population of 1,000 to 1,500 detainees for average stays of 3 to 7 days, which will serve as staging locations for transfers or removals. And the second category, large-scale detention facilities, which will house 7 to 10,000 detainees for periods averaging less than 60 days. It's not clear from the documents which category the Surprise warehouse falls into. One document suggests a projected bed capacity of 1,500, but the documents refer to the warehouse as both a, quote, detention facility and a, quote, processing site. DHS appears to use Surprise Processing Site as the official name of the building. The reengineering document also states that buildings DHS has purchased as part of their expanded detention effort will, quote, maximize operational efficiency, minimize costs, shorten processing times, and promote the safety, dignity, and respect of all aliens in ICE custody. The warehouse build-out will include food service, clothing, medical care, including emergency services, legal resources, religious spaces, and recreational areas. The document also states that the warehouse was subjected to an engineering review, which resulted in a determination that the warehouse will have, quote, no detrimental effect on the city's power and water resources. It says a National Environmental Policy Act survey was conducted for the warehouse, but the results of the survey are not included. The economic impact analysis document contains more specifics. It states that DHS will spend $150 million to retrofit the warehouse and an additional $180 million to operate it during the first 3 years. According to DHS models, the warehouse will support about 1,300 jobs during construction, almost 500 jobs during each year of its operation, and generate over $16 million in annual tax revenue. Surprise Mayor Sarter said he still hasn't received a direct reply from DHS about the warehouse, but based on his review of the documents, he says he's expecting the warehouse to be used as a regional processing center.
We're anticipating the 1,000 to 1,500 detainees here in the city of Surprise. The size of that building, I don't think, would support much more than that.
When asked about the details in the documents, the job estimates, the tax revenue, and the various services DHS says they'll be providing to detainees, Sartor declined to take a position.
That's something that's outside of the control of the city of Surprise. I mean, for me to talk about, you know, the food and all those other things, is not really my expertise or lane as a city. We're mostly focused on making sure that, you know, we can continue to provide for our residents, make sure everybody's safe, make sure that there's no, you know, traffic impacts, and that with this ICE facility, the city can still operate and do all the things that we need to do to make sure that we're providing for our residents.
Sartor repeatedly stressed the need for local firefighters and law enforcement officials to visit the warehouse and make sure their safety concerns are satisfied. He said he's still hoping DHS will provide more details. Sartor and members of the city council are planning to visit Washington in March and have asked for a meeting with DHS officials to address their concerns. They haven't gotten a reply. Regardless of the answers to his questions, Sartor said, the city's options are limited.
Yeah, there's not a ton of recourse. I mean, you look at the federal supremacy clause, and, you know, the federal government doesn't have to comply with our zoning. They don't have to comply with, you know, state laws. And so really, from my perspective, it's about trying to reach out, coordinate, and make sure that we can get ahead of this the best that we can as a city so we can be prepared.
At that five-hour city council meeting earlier this month, many residents said they recognized there's not much the city can do, but called on the mayor to issue a statement or pass a resolution expressing disapproval for the warehouse. Sartor didn't rule that out.
Right now, we're waiting for the response. I think once we get a response, that you will be able to better, you know, kind of assess what we have going on, how that impacts the city, and then take steps from there.
In a separate conversation about the documents, City Councilman Johnny Melton put it more bluntly.
I'm frustrated that I'm in the dark. This thing is not going to reside in a vacuum. Okay. It's in our community. You know, I get it. I can't stop it, but we can ask.
We have sent multiple messages to both DHS and the ICE field office in Phoenix, but have not received a response.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Katina Foundation, Basis Charter Schools and Palo Verde Generating Station, SRP, and the Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more online and on the KJZZ mobile app.